This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربكم ربك سريع العقاب وإنه لغفور رحيم صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things. And no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines: the military conflict between Russia and Ukraine now in its third day. Moscow says over 800 Ukrainian military targets are already destroyed. The EU and the UK target President Putin with sanctions, prompting Moscow to say that ties with the West are nearing a point of no return. Moscow summons the Israeli ambassador over the regime's stance on the conflict in Ukraine shortly after blasting Israel for the occupation of Syria's Golan Heights. Thank you for joining us. The military conflict between Russia and neighboring Ukraine is in its third day, with fighting now reaching the streets of the capital, Kiev. The Ukrainian military says it has repelled a Russian attack in Kiev's Victory Avenue. Gunfire is also reported near government buildings. Clashes are underway with Russian armored units in two locations north of Kiev as well. Ukraine's defense ministry says they have shot down a Russian helicopter, a bomber, and a transport plane in the east. President Volodymyr Zelensky, in a new message, has vowed to defend Kiev.
I am here. We will not lay down the weapons. We will defend our state because our weapon is our truth. And the truth is that this is our land, our country, our children, and we will defend all of that.
Meanwhile, Russian forces say they have captured the city of Melitopol in southeast Ukraine. They have also taken control of a hydroelectric power plant in Kiev. Russia's defense ministry says it's targeted Ukraine's military infrastructure with air and sea-based cruise missiles, destroying 821 targets. The fighting began on Thursday, after Russian President Vladimir Putin authorized a special military operation in Ukraine. Russia has vetoed a United Nations Security Council resolution aimed at condemning Moscow's military action in Ukraine. 11 out of 15 members of the council voted in favor of the draft, while 3 members abstained from the voting. The draft resolution, which was proposed by the United States, is now expected to be taken up by the 193-member UN General Assembly. U.S. Envoy Linda Thomas Greenfield has accused Russia of threatening the international system with its attack on Ukraine. This is while the Russian envoy described the resolution as a brutal and inhumane move. Vasily Nebenzia also slammed Western media for using fake information to spread anti-Russian propaganda. The Chinese representative also called for dialogue to resolve the conflict. Moscow says the relations between the West and Russia have reached the point of no return. The foreign ministry spokeswoman says sanctions against President Vladimir Putin and Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov reflect the West's absolute impotence when it comes to foreign policy. Maria Zakharova added neither Putin nor Lavrov have accounts in Britain or abroad. The reaction came after the United States and Canada announced sanctions against the top two Russian officials over the conflict in Ukraine. The European Union also agreed to impose sanctions against the Russian president and his foreign minister.
EU foreign affairs ministers held talks on Friday in Brussels to bolster the 27-nation bloc's second round of new sanctions against Russia over the Kremlin's military campaign in Ukraine.
Only leaders in the world who are sanctioned by the European Union, Assad from Syria, Lukashenko from Belarus, and now Putin from Russia.
Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has also been added to the sanctions list. The idea is to block banks in the EU from making funds available to the two key Russian figures. Earlier on Friday, EU leaders agreed sanctions on Russia's energy, aviation and financial sectors.
We're now targeting 70% of the Russian banking market, but also key state-owned companies, including the field of defence.
Outside the EU Leaders' Summit, union members staged a peace demonstration.
We don't think to have a war in Ukraine is a good thing for European workers and for Ukrainian workers. So we don't agree with the war.
Leaders from the 30-country NATO alliance held a summit on Friday. The big question is, could moves by the West stoke the flames and turn this crisis into a catastrophe?
NATO allies have and continue to provide support, military, but also different types of equipment to Ukraine.
US troops under the NATO flag have just arrived in Estonia, Latvia and Lithuania. Moscow had requested less provocation from NATO, but it appears those calls continue to fall on deaf ears. According to some analysts, one positive fallout from the crisis could be greater independence for the EU when it comes to foreign policy. The point has been made there will be a realization in the coming months. It is dangerous and extremely costly economically to allow Washington dictate relations between neighbours on the other side of the Atlantic. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Iran's top security official says the West is directly responsible for the ongoing military conflagration in Ukraine. In a tweet, Ali Shamkhani said the West seeks to undermine the national security of countries through various means. He said the West is therefore to blame for the wars and crises that break out to counter this strategy. Prior to launching its so-called special military operation against Ukraine, Russia repeatedly said that its security interests were being threatened by NATO's world expansion. Moscow demanded a permanent ban on Ukraine's membership in the U.S.-led military alliance, arguing that nations cannot gain security at the expense of that of others. The West, however, flatly rejected Russia's demand. The last few days have seen relentless political and economic attacks on Russia over its military operations in neighboring Ukraine. Western governments, among them the UK, have announced crippling sanctions against the country. At the same time, anti-war campaigners have slammed NATO's eastward expansion as the culprit, calling for more diplomatic efforts to end the crisis and avoid a new wave of refugees. Saidpour Reza has more from London.
As missiles fell on Ukrainian cities, so did international condemnation rain down on Russia's attack on Ukraine. In a special leaders' summit Friday, NATO's Secretary General reiterated the alliance's support of Ukraine.
We condemn Russia's aggressions in the strongest possible terms and call on Russia to immediately cease its military action.
A day earlier, EU leaders discussed developments, the scale of which none of them would entirely have foreseen.
From their national capitals, leader after leader promised a coordinated and unprecedented sanctions response aimed at President Putin, the Russian elite, and the sources and havens of Russian wealth, the city of London being one of them.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson set diplomatic niceties aside, describing Vladimir Putin as a dictator before outlining a raft of punitive measures.
We'll be imposing asset freezes on more than 100 new entities and individuals, on top of the hundreds that we've already announced. This includes all the major manufacturers that support Putin's war machine. Furthermore, we are also banning Aeroflot from the UK.
Economic warfare at the expense of negotiation as a means of ending the Ukraine crisis.
Present government or the present arrangement in Ukraine was installed in 2014, 8 years ago. So there's been 8 years of diplomacy, 8 years of opportunities to fix these very serious problems of the national question in Ukraine and of Russian national security. And the only reason we haven't seen those happening is because of the total intransigence of the US and its allies in London, in Berlin, and in Kiev.
And while the West blames Russia for triggering the crisis, others such as Iran and China say the reason behind it should be sought elsewhere.
The US administration, the German administration had assured, given assurances to the Soviets back in 1989, back in 1990, when the two sides were renegotiating the reunification of Germany, that NATO would not expand. You know, the famous quote is, NATO will not expand even 1 inch eastwards of Germany. 30 years later, 14 countries in Eastern and Central Europe have been incorporated into NATO, including countries like Estonia, which share a border with Russia.
The war in Ukraine is ongoing. NATO member Poland says it has opened 9 reception points along Ukraine's border to receive an expected wave of refugees, another outcome of U.S.-led NATO's adventurism. Saeed Bouriza, London.
Russia has summoned Israel's ambassador to Moscow demanding an explanation as to why Tel Aviv was against the Kremlin's military operation in Ukraine. Russia's deputy foreign minister, Mikhail Bogdanov, asked Alexander Ben-Zvi to explain why Israel was expressing support for, quote, the Nazis in Ukraine. The Russian diplomat also said Moscow expected Tel Aviv to understand what his country's motives were for the military operation in Ukraine. Prior to that operation, Russia had taken issue with Israeli sovereignty over the occupied Golan Heights. On Wednesday, Russia's deputy ambassador to the UN, Dmitry Polyansky, said the Kremlin did not recognize Israel's sovereignty over the Golan Heights that are part of Syria. Moving on, Iran's permanent ambassador to the United Nations says the continued presence of foreign forces in Syria has provided favorable conditions for terrorist activities there. But before we move further ahead with that news piece, let me just read out to you the breaking news that we are receiving. According to emergency services, an apartment block has been hit by a missile. Well, the conflict in Ukraine has entered its third day. We will keep a close eye on that, and we will keep you informed of the latest developments as soon as we get them. Majid Takht Rabonchi condemned the presence of foreign forces in Syria as illegal and called for their immediate withdrawal. He said fighting terrorism cannot be used as an excuse to undermine Syria's sovereignty and territorial integrity. The Iranian envoy stressed that the presence of terrorist groups like Daesh in Syria poses threats to regional and international security too. Takht Rabonchi was speaking at a Security Council meeting. He also condemned Israel's continued airstrikes on Syria, calling them a flagrant violation of international law. The Iranian envoy called on the Security Council to take action to stop the Israeli attacks. Iran's foreign minister insists that the Islamic Republic will not cross its red lines in talks with the remaining signatories to the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the comments in a phone call with his Russian counterpart. Sergei Lavrov, for his part, said Moscow continues to support Tehran's stance in the Vienna talks. Iran is still engaged in diplomatic efforts with the other JCPOA parties to revive the accord. The Chinese president says his country is ready to work with North Korea to develop relations, quote, under a new situation. According to North Korean media, Xi Jinping has sent a message to Kim Jong-un in which he has stressed the importance of cooperation between Beijing and Pyongyang. The media didn't specify what the new situation in the message referred to. Earlier this week, Kim vowed to cooperate with Beijing in a bid to foil what he called threats posed by the U.S. and its allies. China is North Korea's closest ally and its biggest trade partner. South Korea has hit a peak of more than 170,000 new daily cases, an increase of 60,000 per day this week as the Omicron variant of COVID-19 spreads. The surge jeopardizes plans to open the economy and ease restrictions. With the school term set to begin next week, concern grows over whether classes should be online or in person and whether vaccines should be mandated. Frank Smith reports from the South Korean capital, Seoul.
The Omicron variant exploded in South Korea this week, with new daily cases increasing 50% to 170,000 per day. South Korea's surge in the Omicron variant of COVID-19 comes as other countries with declining cases relax lockdown measures. So despite the increase in new cases of the Omicron variant here in South Korea, the government's under increasing pressure to end social distancing restrictions and open up social and economic activity. Small business people suffering from limits in hours and capacity have rallied for an end to the restrictions. The school year begins next week. Many believe classes should go ahead in person.
Insisting on virtual classes is not realistic because we don't know when the COVID-19 pandemic will end. So the government's decision looks reasonable to me, as long as there are proper measures like vaccines for the children to minimize the risk.
Some parents' group protested against vaccine mandates for teenagers amid reports of a handful of deaths attributed to vaccinations. Doctors maintain the public health benefits of getting the jab, including resuming in-person classes at school.
For students, offline, in-person class is very important, especially for the youngest. But the danger of infection is still there, and a child's infection leads to the whole family's infection. So it's better to start with offline classes until enough of the 5 to 11-year-old age group has been vaccinated.
South Korea's medical authorities this week approved the Pfizer vaccine for young children. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Heavy downpours trigger floods in eastern Australia, killing two and leaving behind a trail of destruction. The latest deaths happened in Queensland state. They bring to four the total number of people killed in floods since early this week. Another two people are still missing. The rising waters have inundated homes and roads and swept away cars. In Queensland, more than 250 people have been evacuated while thousands of homes remain without power. Authorities say a month of rain was recorded in just one day in some areas of the state. They warn that there will be more downpours in the upcoming days, creating an extremely dangerous situation. People in the state of New South Wales have also been told to brace for heavy storms this weekend. And a powerful earthquake hits Indonesia's largest island, Sumatra. At least seven people have been confirmed dead. Dozens more are injured. Some buildings, including a government office, have been damaged. The quake was followed by over a dozen aftershocks and caused tremors in neighboring Singapore and Malaysia. Earthquakes frequently shake Indonesia as the country is placed in a seismically active zone. In 2009, about 1,000 people were killed by a powerful quake there.
Well, that's your world news for now. Stay tuned.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all. From the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee, and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
In the Limelight.
Anti-war advocates have recently denounced the corporate media for giving former National Security Advisor John Bolton, a longtime proponent of regime change and U.S. military action around the world, a platform to discuss his views on the current tension in Ukraine. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Julia Conley, journalist. This article is published under the heading, "Critics Want to Know Why Bloodthirsty Warmonger John Bolton Still Invited on TV." Here's the story. Anti-war advocates recently denounced the corporate media for giving former National Security Advisor John Bolton, a longtime proponent of regime change and U.S. military action around the world, a platform to discuss his views on the current tension in Ukraine. MSNBC host Andrea Mitchell invited the former official for the Trump and George W. Bush administrations to discuss how U.S. President Joe Biden should confront Russia. Bolton said that amid news that Russian parliament has authorized the use of military force and Putin issued new demands that Ukraine recognize Russia's claim to Crimea and that the West end weapons shipments there, the Biden administration must swiftly take aggressive action against Russia. John Bolton is a neocon whose foreign policy has been consistently proven wrong. He was wrong about Iraq. He has been wrong about the West Asia region. He was wrong about Afghanistan. Bolton's comments came shortly before Biden announced the White House is joining the European Union in imposing a first round of sanctions against Russian individuals and groups in response to Putin's official recognition of the self-proclaimed People's Republic of Donetsk and Luhansk in eastern Ukraine. Biden announced sanctions against two financial institutions, sovereign debt, and elite individuals in Russia recently, calling them the first tranche of U.S. sanctions and saying the country could take more action if Russian forces advance further into Ukraine. Bolton advised the White House to bring the guillotine down on all the sanctions they have been contemplating and take additional steps in order to avoid further military action by Russia, adding that the U.S. should have placed more troops in Ukraine several months ago. "I think we should have had more American forces in Ukraine, not to fight the Russians, but to train with the Ukrainians and to show those Russian generals looking across the border and seeing American flags," Bolton told Mitchell, adding, "Biden took that off the table, saying there would be no American forces involved, and he got nothing for it." Considering Bolton's record as a war hawk who aggressively pushed the false claim that Iraq harbored weapons of mass destruction to justify the 2003 invasion of the country, urged former President Donald Trump to withdraw from the nuclear Iran deal against the advice of international experts, and urged regime change in Venezuela, critics, including Win Without War, called on media outlets to stop giving John Bolton airtime. "Why is this person on my TV?" asked Andrew Lawrence of Media Matters for America, while podcast host Kylie Kolonsky called Bolton literally the last person on earth who should be giving foreign policy advice right now. Mehdi Hassan, who also hosts a political news show on MSNBC, warned recently that media outlets that interview Bolton amid flaring tensions in Ukraine must at least ask him some tough questions. Hassan tweeted, "We really, really don't need John Bolton's opinions on a new war."
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In late August 2021, almost 2 weeks after the fall of the government in Kabul, U.S. President Joe Biden delivered a speech in defense of withdrawing American troops from Afghanistan.
To those asking for a third decade of war in Afghanistan, I ask, what is the vital national interest? In my view, we only have one. To make sure Afghanistan can never be used again to launch an attack on our homeland.
The withdrawal was chaotic, but the president had taken his bold decision and stance. Now, more than 1 year into Biden's presidency, this boldness looks like a temporary aberration in U.S. foreign policy. The White House has followed a foreign policy that is unclear on core issues. This chaotic approach has shown itself most vividly in the Biden administration's effort to revive the Iran nuclear deal, known also as the JCPOA.
It's not time to give up. There is some progress being made. The P5 plus one is on the same page, but it remains to be seen.
Yeah. In his presidential campaign in 2020, Biden left little doubt concerning the deal. In an op-ed for CNN, he wrote, "If Iran returns to strict compliance with the nuclear deal, the United States would rejoin the agreement as a starting point for follow-on negotiations." But in practice, Biden has shown indecisiveness so far. For months, the U.S. president and his team debated whether to enter the JCPOA or to seek a new agreement. After the administration decided to re-enter, it began an after-you game with Iran, laying out a set of conditions and asking Tehran to make the first move, which Tehran rejected outright.
I have to tell you, recent moves, recent rhetoric, don't give us a lot of cause for optimism. But even though the hour is getting very late, it is not too late for Iran to reverse course and engage meaningfully in an effort to return to mutual compliance with the JCPOA.
The Iranians say since the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the deal, it ought to take the first move, meaning to lift sanctions and to unfreeze Iran's financial assets. Moreover, given Biden's predecessor's unpredictability, the Iranians want the White House to guarantee that it won't repeat what Trump did in 2018 when he pulled out of the deal. That said, when it comes to nuclear agreements, the Americans never follow through on their word. For example, in 1994, the U.S. signed the framework agreement with North Korea to end its nuclear program, but the U.S. never lived up to its obligations under the deal, which included the construction of a light water nuclear reactor and normalizing diplomatic relations, and Pyongyang walked away. Or in the case of Libya, Muammar Gaddafi voluntarily gave up his nuclear program, but that didn't stop the U.S. from actively supporting forces who toppled his government and brutally killed him.
Of course, the big news this week, Gaddafi's dead, rebel forces, killed by rebel forces. Your reaction, your take on this?
Well, this is somebody who for 40 years had terrorized his country, had supported terrorism, and he had an opportunity during the Arab Spring to finally let loose of his grip on power and to peacefully transition to democracy. We gave him ample opportunity and he wouldn't do it.
Trump's withdrawal from the Iran deal is just the latest case. Against such a backdrop, demanding even more concessions from Tehran does not seem to be the wisest move to revive the deal.
We are very clear-eyed about the hurdles that remain. These talks will be structured around working groups that the EU is going to form with the remaining partners in the JCPOA, including Iran. And the primary issues that will be discussed are the nuclear steps that Iran would need to take in order to return to compliance with the JCPOA.
Since most of the sanctions on Iran are based on executive action, there is nothing stopping Biden from going back into the deal. But it seems that Biden is unwilling to upset Iran hawks on Capitol Hill, in particular Senator Bob Menendez of New Jersey, who is the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Since Menendez is a vocal critic of the Iran nuclear deal, Biden is reportedly afraid of provoking him because he would block or slow roll the administration's foreign policy nominees. As Matt Duss, foreign policy advisor to Senator Bernie Sanders, put it, they don't hate the deal because it's a bad deal. They hate the deal because it's a deal with Iran. Full stop. On the JCPOA, there is no consensus to be built with the anti-Iran hawks. The enmity towards Iran is partly due to pressure from powerful interest groups, including the pro-Israel lobby. As Bill Clinton's Middle East envoy Kenneth Pollack once said, from a political standpoint, nobody pays a price to be tough on Iran.
And this is the same spirit that, you know, I want to bring to our relationship of cooperation, of goodwill, of friendship. We're going to be talking about a bunch of issues, primarily how do we fend off and curtail Iran's pursuit to dominate the region.
Israel's security is and always will be unshakable. And we look forward to addressing all of these challenges that we face, particularly regional security and the deep concerns that we share about Iran and the role that it's playing in the region, including its nuclear program.
It's very unlikely that Biden will be able or at least willing to defy this lobby. When Barack Obama came into office, he tried to ease mistrust between Tehran and Washington through a series of peacemaking gestures, such as addressing the Iranians on their new year or writing letters to the leaders of Iran.
So in this season of new beginnings, I would like to speak clearly to Iran's leaders. We have serious differences that have grown over time. My administration is now committed to diplomacy that addresses the full range of issues before us and to pursuing constructive ties among the United States, Iran, and the international community.
But he finally gave in to pressure from then-Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and as a result adopted anti-Iran policies by imposing sanctions on the country. It was just late in his presidency when he decided to reach an agreement with Iran. Biden, who was Obama's vice president, is now confronted with a similar anti-Iran scenario. Recently, about 200 House Republicans wrote to Biden warning any nuclear deal made with Iran without Congress approval will meet the same fate as the 2015 agreement by Obama, which was later abandoned by Trump. On the other hand, Biden's plunging approval rating has made the administration more timid in its approach to international affairs. Biden is afraid of the backlash from appearing to make concessions to the Islamic Republic. In the words of Jeffrey Lewis of the Middlebury Institute of International Studies, Biden is a wimp. He would have taken a political hit for taking a chance on the Iranians that might or might not have worked out, but it would have put the ball in Iran's court. Trump is gone, but his Iran policy is still in place. If the Biden administration wants to be more than a historical footnote on U.S. foreign policy, it needs to be more decisive. It needs to take action on decisions it has adopted rhetorically. The clock is ticking.
In the limelight.
The Louisiana Senate recently continued the state's long history of racial oppression by voting down Senator Cleo Field's congressional redistricting map. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Ashley K. Shelton, writer. This article is published under the heading Redistricting Tactics Threaten to Suppress Black Representation in Louisiana. Here's more. The Louisiana Senate recently continued the state's long history of racial oppression by voting down Senator Cleo Field's congressional redistricting map. What's more, the Louisiana House voted down Representative Randall Gaines' congressional redistricting map. Gaines is a veteran and civil rights attorney who represents one of the area's hardest hit by Hurricane Ida, and Fields is an attorney and former congressman. Gaines and Fields' proposals included two majority-minority districts, electoral districts where the majority of the constituents are people of color, giving them an opportunity to elect candidates of their choice, something black voters in the state advocated for. Since the black population has grown in Louisiana, an additional seat representing this shift is warranted, just and fair. But in Louisiana, as in other parts of the country, map drawers are refusing to create new electoral opportunities for communities of color. What's more, they are actively dismantling black voting power by carving up black communities in some states or packing black communities into fewer districts in other states. These manipulative tactics make it harder for black voters to elect candidates of choice, regardless of turnout or black population growth. Across the state, countless voters expressed the need for legislators to add an additional majority-minority district given that 33% of the state's population is black. Louisiana has six congressional districts, one-third of six is two. Rather than surrendering to the will of the people or the logic of population growth, legislators continue machinations that will silence voters. State Senator Sharon Hewitt suggested she was actually protecting black voters by not creating a second majority-minority district because she didn't think a 51-52% majority black district would turn out to vote, meaning they wouldn't be able to elect a candidate of choice. But many black voters would take 51-52% any day over not having a committed and representative voice. No legislator should be able to unilaterally decide what voters need. Voters should have more influence. In the absence of a process that levels the playing field by allowing voters to select who represents them, legislators have outsized influence. For instance, U.S. current Congressional House delegation sits in several powerful committees. As the second poorest state in the country, Louisianans are not benefiting or growing from this representation. In fact, the U.S. delegation recently voted against the president's infrastructure bill, with the exception of Congressman Troy Carter, who currently holds the only majority black seat. The resistance could have blocked a wonderful opportunity to invest in crumbling infrastructure. This is a risk Americans cannot continue to take. It is clear that any maps with an additional district will never make it out of committee. State leaders will certainly try to amend on the floor, much like they did on the Senate side when State Senator Fields made a powerful and compelling plea for his colleagues to do the right thing. The next step is for a map with only one majority-minority district to go before Governor John Bel Edwards, who can and should veto the map. Edwards should unite with the people of color in his state, particularly since black voters helped propel him into office. For his part, Governor Edwards said he would veto unfair maps. He would be in good company. Governor Andy Beshear of Kentucky and Governor Laura Kelly of Kansas vetoed the racially discriminatory maps put forth by legislatures in their states. Their vetoes were overturned, but the willingness to support the people of their state will be reflected in the history books. Moreover, several residents from three Kansas counties sued to block the state's newly passed congressional maps, which conservatives in the state passed in early February. Louisiana has the second largest black population in the country, second only to Mississippi. If the governors of Kansas and Kentucky, who have much smaller black populations, can stand for equity and fairness, Governor Edwards can certainly do the same. There can be no protection without representation. Much of what has happened during redistricting process seems to be heading toward litigation. In what scenario would anyone take less than they deserve? The truth is that immigration is driving population shifts in the United States, and most of the people immigrating to this country are people of color, including black immigrants. Legislators cannot hold communities of color hostage by continually drawing district lines and ignore population growth. As Americans think about redistricting, they should ground it in the broader fight for freedom. As Devonta Lewis, Director of Public Affairs an outrage for Louisiana budget project noted in his testimony before the House Governmental Affairs Committee. Black people have endured decades of trauma. Legislators can help ensure progress by drawing fair maps and allowing voters of color to elect candidates of their choice. To gaslight voters by downplaying their population growth is a continuation of their traumatic history. All people deserve elected officials who will advocate for them. Legislators should not be able to cherry-pick their voters. But unless and until Americans have an equitable process, legislators will continue to thwart the will of the people, especially when the people are black, people of color, or persons living in poverty.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his immaculate progeny. Dear brothers and sisters, all over the world, assalamu alaikum and welcome to yet another edition from series of Q&A in Islamic beliefs from IRB English Radio. In this series of shows, we are trying to focus on the doubts and misconceptions posed by different questioners all around the world concerning the Islamic issues. For this, we have invited an Islamic scholar from Qom Seminary Schools to join us in this studio and answer our questions. I'd like to welcome Sheikh Nur Muhammad into this show and say salam to him. Sheikh, assalamu alaikum and welcome to this show.
Salam alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
It's a great pleasure for us to have you here, Sheikh. Some days and nights, it is being said that the moon is in the status of Al-Aqrab, Qamar fi Burj Al-Aqrab. I wanted to ask you if these recommendations that have been mentioned are not to perform and not to do some actions and activities in such days, does it have any religious base, or are they coming from a, let's say, a reliable source? And then, is it really important for us to know about the celestial bodies and their positions in the skies and heavens? And are we to check all their, let's say, status and positions and to tune our lives based on them?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Thank you for this valid question. You see that talking about celestial body and the impact of that on the, you know, behavior of human being, generally speaking, the point that you mentioned, we have in one narration that when there is moon in Scorpio, and or for example in Farsi we say Qamar dar Aghrab, it is dislike to, for example, to have some kind of marriage, actually, to have marriage in that time. We have only this narration talking about this issue, and most of the scholars, they said this is dislike, not forbidden to do that. Mm-hmm. I want to say that it is only for the time of the for the marriage, and for one or two things has been mentioned in that particular narration, not more than that.
Very true.
It doesn't mean that, for example, when moon in Scorpio, it is, for example, you cannot do anything or all things are forbidden. No, at all.
For example, it is being said that you are not allowed to go to a trip, and it's better not to take a trip decide to have a child in those days and nights.
I want to say that in this in the talking about this narration, we just suffice ourselves with the what has been mentioned in the narration. It mm-hmm. is dislike to go to the trip, or for example to have
is
a
it
marriage.
Only a matter of like and dislike? I mean, it's a matter of to be good or bad or no. There is sort of prevention in these hadith or narrations.
The prevention is to the you know extent of dislike, karaha. Okay. Mm-hmm. Not it is forbidden. Okay, the point. But generally speaking, let me go to the talking about the basis of this idea, whether we can have this kind of bad omen or good omen or not. Mm-hmm. It is, I think, more important than this idea.
True.
You see that if you go to the narrations of Ahlul Bayt and to the verses of Noble Quran, first of all, you see this verse of Noble Quran, "Inna tatayyarna bikum." We have bad omen about you. Yeah. Okay. Quran, Noble Quran, refute this idea. Okay?
Yes.
He said that the idea of bad omen or good omen, it is basically wrong. قَالُوا طَائِرُكُمْ مَعَكُمْ أَيْنْ ذُكِّرْتُمْ بَلْ أَنْتُمْ قَوْمٌ مُسْرِفُونَ Noble Quran said that whatever you do, طَائِرُكُمْ مَعَكُمْ means your action, your a'mal, your behavior is with you.
Yeah.
Whatever you do is with you. Okay, and it does not separate from you. And of course, if you remember and if you remind by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, you are the transgressor and you are out of the limits.
True.
You see that Noble Quran wanted to say that, or for example, we have ayyam al-nahisat, the days which are have some kind of bad omen. Of course, this is a literal translation of the verse.
Mm-hmm.
But generally speaking, when Noble Quran talks about the bad omen days,
yeah.
For example, these days are have some kind of bad omen. Noble Quran wanted to say that the reason that particular day is has some kind of, you know, evil within it, it is because of your action.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yeah.
When your action is evil, you have some kind of consequence. You have some consequence for that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And it has some negative consequence for you.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
So, sorry, let me interrupt you here and ask an important question, which actually nullifies our previous explanations in previous shows. I want you to correct me, Sheikhuna. You said that earlier, that time and place is very important for us, for example, to perform some